You're listening to Money Never Sleeps Radio. In your face.
What we got here is a failure to communicate.
Oh, have I got your attention now?
Greed, for lack of a better word, is good.
You know what I mean?
Money to be made in a place like this.
Money never sleeps, pal.
You're crazy. Don't run when you lose. Don't whine when it hurts.
You know what it takes to sell real estate?
It takes brass.
I'm falling, and I can't get up.
All right, welcome to Money Never Sleeps. This is a show where we talk about anything and everything that impacts the flow of money from around the corner to around the world. I want to thank you for tuning in. We try to tackle topics that we believe that would be of interest to our listeners. And I want to give a big shout out to Tom. We had a great conversation, and he brought up some points that I want to actually address on air, because I think that there are a lot of listeners out there that may have the same questions to, you know, and it's good to have a better understanding of it. I want to talk about the real difference between decentralization and centralization. Now, basically, in that type of conversation, it begins with the fundamental divide between decentralization and centralization. Centralized systems, they rely on a single authority, one point. Whether it be a bank, government, or institutions, they are the authority. They validate all transactions. They maintain the ledgers. They control access. And this is what banks want and need, I guess, for them to control the environment. They don't want assets going off their books. They don't want savings or yield type of products leaving their ecosystem, because it does impact the bank. And if you look at it from a local level to a regional level to a national level to an international level, on a local level, when money starts moving out, there's less money to, you know, to put to work in those local areas. So that's part of their concern, which is valid, but there's a lot more to it. Decentralized networks, they distribute that power across, that power of maintaining ledgers, access, everything, validation, that power is distributed across nodes, validators, and community governance. It reduces a single point of failure. It increases transparency. Basically, you don't have one single authority making decisions. The difference matters because it shapes who controls financial infrastructure, who benefits from it, and how resilient it is. As global finance evolves, the tension between centralized control and decentralized autonomy, that is going to become one of the defining debates of the digital era. There's no question. In blockchain or in just in tokenization, that's going to be a defining debate. You know, this is why we see the Clarity Act kind of at a standstill. Banks want something. They want to be able to buy time, I guess, to go and create products where they can have a yielding stablecoin, same as they have a savings account. They don't want those assets to leave the banking environment. And that's why you have a lot of banks teaming up with other banks to create these products. You have, you know, whether it be Circle and even, you know, just fintech companies like that creating centralized situations where institutions globally can get involved. Now, why are big banks adopting blockchain at all? And why do they prefer to use centralized networks? I touched on this a pinch. Major financial institutions, and you have to understand what they're doing now. You can look at the news, you can look things up, go on Google, do a search. They're aggressively adopting blockchain technology. You see a lot of tokenization happening. But you have a number of the banks, as I mentioned, they're leaning towards centralized blockchain networks rather than public ones. JP Morgan has been doing this for some time, and they were barking for a while. Jamie Dimon was barking a while about from Bitcoin itself being a pet rock to things, you know, this being a flash type of thing, a flash in a pan. But in the meanwhile, they adopted blockchain technology, which underpins all of this. You know, they went from doing probably 100 million to running trillions of dollars, trillions, not millions, not billions, trillions of dollars using their blockchain network, using their stablecoin. Banks, they prioritize compliance, predictable governance, and controlled access. And these are features that actually make it easier to enforce while in permission systems, centralized systems. Public blockchain is a little more difficult. They are transparent, no question. They're censor resistant, no question. But there are variables in there that institutions aren't comfortable with. This is why they won't adopt certain blockchains until they adhere to what they need. You know, open participation, unpredictable validators, decentralized governance. This is what makes them uncomfortable because it can put them at risk. So this is why you have, whether it be Ethereum, Pico Novus, other blockchains, they're creating an environment where it would make institutions feel more comfortable. Now, this preference from institutions just realize, I mean, it just makes you realize, and it makes the blockchain community realize that this is peeling off a layer and is showing how traditional finance wants blockchain's efficiency. They want that automation, but they don't want to give up control. They don't want to give up control to the masses. And basically, that's setting the stage for a hybrid future. And I've been talking about this for the longest time, a convergence where you have centralized and decentralized systems coming together, DeFi, TradFi, converging to coexist, work together, because traditional finance is not going away. People, you know, really think that while DeFi, decentralized finance, is going to wipe traditional finance out. No, it's really not. Okay, since the days of Babylon to Amsterdam, you know, we had the first exchanges, the first stock exchange that developed. You know, throughout history, you know, you have a traditional financial system that evolved not over a couple of months or a couple of years, over centuries. So it's not going away, all right? And it's not a matter of, oh, well, decentralized finance is going to win. Both areas win. They're going to win together. And that's what's going to wind up happening. Okay, and this matters for a reason, because this is a global impact. Global impact. The choice between centralized and decentralized blockchain models, they're going to shape the future of global markets. Centralized networks, they're going to streamline settlement, reduce fraud, improve cross-border efficiency. But they also run the risk of recreating some of the bottlenecks that blockchain is supposed to fix. And these power structures, again, that blockchain was supposed to fix and disrupt, and this is why, you know, blockchain is being adopted for these reasons. And that's what the decentralized finance community is worried about, that it's going to go back to what it's been, just taking the new technology for it. It doesn't have to be that way. There has to be compromises on both ends, and that's a reality. Okay, you know, the impact, you know, is going to be profound, right? And it's, again, in my opinion, it's not a matter of one model dominating another model. You know, it comes down to how the capital is going to flow. And I believe that capital will flow with hybrid systems, with a convergence, okay? And it's going to flow with whoever has access, because the more access you give globally, the more will happen. If you have just solely centralized networks, you are limiting. You're putting a geofence around your blockchain system. So now, the only way people can do things there, if they're a part of your ecosystem. You know, wouldn't it be nice to have your system a part of something bigger, more global. Gives people the ability to move things around. And if done the right way, you can control your immediate ecosystem. If they use, you know, what was created with Piku Novus and Hootex, where you can have, you know, basically you have a main token and you have a subdivision of that token. You have a subset of that token, which allows you to actually control your environment and reduce the implementation of fraudulent tactics easily just by controlling what you interact with. And again, this is not just a technical debate. It's a geopolitical one. It's an economic one. And this is, I believe that this debate will have answers to, you know, as we move forward. You know, many institutions right now, they started developing Ethereum because Ethereum, they launched, Ethereum was sliding down, they were losing developers, and with Tom Lee, with Bitmine, and that whole initiative created Ethereum Institutional. And that actually is allowing them to wake up and say, hey, we are built for this, so use us to be a part of it. So you have institutions that are developing on Ethereum because it offers a mature ecosystem, programmable smart contracts, and compatibility with tokenized frameworks. You know, like Piku Novus right now is compliant with ERC-20 and EVM, the networks, and that helps because the more that Ethereum expands, the more that it brings forward the blockchains that have this compliance on a protocol level, not bridges on a protocol level, because bridges can be broken, bridges can be hacked, and there's a lot of things that can happen. We've seen it time and time again, where you had you know, these bridges actually compromised. And a lot of people lost a lot, and you know, you want to try to prevent that. Okay, and Ethereum's infrastructure, they allow banks to create digital assets, automate compliance, integrate with existing DeFi liquidity pools and the like. It gives them a lot more flexibility in what they do. Even when institutions operate on permissioned versions of Ethereum, they still benefit from the tooling, the developer base, and interoperability that the public chain pioneered. See, that's where I go back to the convergence of things. There is a happy medium where all of this can come together, and it will. It's just egos and everything have to get out the way. You know, banks can benefit, financial institutions can benefit in a massive way, and so could the decentralized finance community. And just staying on Ethereum for a second, Ethereum, look, they complement institutional efforts. They provide a flexible foundation for tokenized financial products. We see it, settlement networks and cross-chain bridges. Now let me touch on Piku Novus. Because of Hootex and the different products, financial products that are created, you know, there is a high fidelity protocol that's in place that even adheres more to the institutional level that they're looking for. And this is where it gets interesting. You know, so it's not just about one blockchain prevailing. It's not just about decentralized finance or centralized finance prevailing. There's going to be a mashup of a few things. Okay, but I'm telling you that we do have a major shift that is underway. As we see institutions, they're beginning to launch some decentralized financial products to reach global liquidity. And we see it. They're doing this, and they're doing it for a reason, because they don't want to be stuck in their ecosystem. Not all banks. I'm not talking about banks doing this. I'm talking about other financial institutions, the BlackRocks, the Goldman Sachs of the world, that type of thing, from tokenized private credit to, you know, even potentially decentralized ETFs, real estate tokens. Okay, on-chain structured products, they're all emerging as new asset classes. By issuing these products on decentralized rails, what institutions are doing, they're gaining access to global investors, where you can have someone that's in a city or someone that's in a bush. If they want to get involved, as long as they have an internet connection, they'll be able to. And they don't need your permission to do so. They can just go in there and get involved. That's the beauty of DeFi. Now you're going to have, you know, they benefit, the institutions benefit from 24/7 liquidity. Automated settlement doesn't take anything further for them to do. Programmable compliance allows them to stay compliant within their rules and regulations that are in place. This evolution is transforming everything from private credit markets to real estate investment vehicles to ETFs. You know, look, they're enabling fractional ownership and borderless participation in ways traditional finance could never achieve. You know, there was a time in France, and this is a fun, useless information, but there was a time in France before Napoleon came in, where they tokenized, that was the real first utilization of monetizing land. You know, France took and they grabbed land from the churches and they took it, and as opposed to going and giving silver back money or silver coins, they gave paper. They gave paper that showed, that represented fractional ownership of that land. And that's what they did with people. And it didn't work out too well, but that's what they did, right? Now things will work out a little better because, you know, we're talking about being in the era of the rise of tokenized everything. Real estate, private credit, ETFs, on-chain projects. This is the tokenization era. Tokenization is reshaping how assets are created, traded, and managed. You cannot argue with that. Private credit becomes more transparent and accessible when tokenized. It's not just held at one firm. The firm can actually go and do the private credit, and then they can tokenize it. So they can monetize it, get more fiat in to go create more products. That's a beautiful cycle. ETFs can be represented as on-chain baskets with automated rebalancing. We, you know, that we have right now in Hootex with digital basket tokens. It's kind of like an ETF, like a trading account, but it works similarly. And that's something that institutions can actually reach out to Hootex to try to, you know, work that into what they're doing. Now, real estate can be fractionalized. And basically, you can have a prime piece of real estate, break it into pieces, and it allows global investors to participate in the projects that were once geographically restricted, or is who you know to get involved. If you didn't know the broker, you didn't know the developer, you didn't know the owner, you weren't getting involved. Here, you can get involved autonomously, right? You can just get involved just by owning the token and getting the benefits of it. You know, tokenized projects, from everything from infrastructure to renewable energy, you know, they can raise capital more efficiently and distribute returns automatically if done the right way. This is a shift, not a theoretical one, but a major shift. It's already happening across major financial markets, and it's accelerating rapidly. You know, every day there's something coming out. I can't keep up with it on the show. I know what's happening, but I can't keep up with it and inform everyone on the show. But, you know, we try to do our best. But everything's moving that quickly, right? You know, there's something called a digital credit note token, and that's something that was specifically created and built on the Pico Novus blockchain. It is accessible through Hootex as a decentralized trading crypto exchange. One of the most transformative innovations is the emergence of this, the DCNs. Because the DCNs, they allow financial institutions to issue credit obligations on-chain with programmable terms, automatic yield distribution, and global reach. They can operate in both centralized and decentralized environments. That's the beauty of it. You can control the access, making them ideal for banks, funds, and enterprises. And this is what they were made for, to be a hybrid. Digital credit note tokens, they enable autonomous interest payments. Happens every hour on the hour like clockwork. Real-time risk monitoring and instant settlement. Their flexibility makes them suitable for private credit. No question. Private credit issuers need this. They want to get liquidity, because if you have $100 million in private credit that's out there, just imagine going and having the ability to tokenize that, have a digital credit note token, issue it to the general public, just get it out there, and now you're raising more capital. You're bringing more capital in to go do more deals without actually going and compromising your positions right there. Because private credit, you know, has been under stress because people want their money now. They want it back now. So pulling that out compromises the whole structure of how private credit works. You know, so this gives an option, monetization of the private credit. And again, this is a beautiful thing. It's fantastic. And it helps trade finance, treasury operations, cross-border lending, all of this stuff. It unlocks a new era of financial automation and monetization and liquidity. And it gives that private credit issuer the ability, as I said, to go and monetize what they have now. Get other types of monetization coming in, other funds coming in, so you can issue more private credit and let the cycle go on. You know, you can have $100 million in private credit out there, and you can turn that into, you know, additional, you know, $300 million in issuances that you would have over the course of a certain amount of time. You know, so it's going to be an interesting dynamic. And look, this all matters for the future of finance. This is why I speak about this on the show. The convergence of institutional blockchain adoption, decentralized liquidity, tokenized assets, and programmable credit instruments, they signal a fundamental shift in global finance. Fundamental. Centralized systems, they will continue to exist. You can't get rid of that. But decentralized networks, well, they're going to expand access. So there has to be some convergence there. They reduce friction and democratize participation. The institutions that embrace both models, not one, both models, and they leverage decentralization for reach and centralization for compliance, well, those financial institutions, they're going to shape the next generation of financial infrastructure. This is why BlackRock is all in, Goldman is all in, JP Morgan, they're going to start changing things up. You have DTCC, they're getting involved in the game, NASDAQ, New York Stock Exchange, so on and so forth. This doesn't stop. This is just the beginning. This is the first layer of the onion being peeled off. This is the story that you're going to tell the next generation of the evolution of finance. This is the story of how finance becomes faster, more global, more transparent, and more programmable. I wanted to touch on this topic to give a little clarity and a little color to how this convergence of centralized and decentralized finance needs to come together. It needs to come together, and it will. It will. Just give it some time. But again, this is the end of the show. I want to thank you for tuning in. And again, I'm going to continue to bring on topics. We are going to continue to bring on topics that we feel that are relevant to our listeners. And again, it's not all going to be about crypto. It's not all going to be about blockchain. It's not all going to be about, you know, one thing or another. We're going to talk about other things, you know, so that we can keep the show fresh, interesting. And if you have any ideas for topics, please feel free to let us know. All right, on that note, thank you for tuning in to Money Never Sleeps Radio, and we'll be back with you with the next episode soon. Until then, you guys have a great trading week. Thank you.
Initiating shutdown sequence.
You're listening to UCW Radio in your face.
What is your major malfunction?
So let it be written. So let it be done.
Ladies and gentlemen, my mother thanks you. My father thanks you. My sister thanks you. And I thank you.
The views and opinions expressed on Money Never Sleeps Radio are for informational purposes only and should not be construed as financial advice. The host Louis Velazquez and guests of Money Never Sleeps Radio are not licensed financial advisors, and any investment decisions made based on information presented in this podcast are at the listener's own risk. Listeners are encouraged to consult with a qualified financial advisor or investment professional before making any investment decisions. The podcast hosts and guests do not endorse or recommend any specific investment strategies or products. All investments involve risk, and past performance is not indicative of future results.